Welcome back to Hot Takes and Deep Dives, and I am here with the man of the hour. You know him as your favorite scene stealer in both Fire Island and Showtime's I Love That For You. But let's face it, he is the leading man in the top culture podcast, Las Culturistas. It is truly my favorite show. I could not be more excited for this. Welcome back, Matt Rogers.
I am so excited to be back, Jess. Thank you for having me. We were just saying, like, the last time we talked to you, like, or last time I talked to you, rather, like, Quibi was something that we thought was going to work.
Which is why I love that joke in Fire Island. Like, oh, yeah, I know, like, right? Invest a lot of money into Quibi.
Well, I've been watching a lot of screenings with a bunch of other people, like with the premiere, and then we were out on Fire Island watching a screening, and that Quibi joke that Margaret says in the movie hits the hardest every single time.
I mean, there's so much I want to cover with you. We're going to get into Fire Island in approximately 5 minutes, but what I first want to say is we are both Long Islanders.
Yep.
Which town are you from?
I'm from, I graduated high school in Islip. And so I actually grew up in West Babylon and then moved over to Islip when I was 8 or 9. And my parents actually live in West Babylon to this day.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, they moved out of Islip after I graduated and went to West Babylon. So Suffolk County, South Shore.
You were already, yeah. So I'm from the South Shore as well, but closer to like Long Beach, like Oceanside. Like I went to Oceanside High School. So
oh, okay.
Kind of. It's, you know, for lack of a better word, trash. I mean,
that's everyone from Long Island refers to themselves as that. You know what I mean? But the thing is, like, it's such an interesting place to grow up because there is like really, really wealthy areas, like some of the wealthiest, and then truly like very, very low income. So you really, I don't think I understood it at the time, but what I was really seeing was like a true class disparity. And honestly, like if we're being real, like it's very segregated. Like it's really not a lot of concentrated diversity at all. And I didn't know that until I left and went back, but it's mm-hmm. it's really kind of surreal in terms of, you know, observing that way of life having been away.
I know that you didn't grow up like going to Fire Island.
See, I didn't grow up going to the Fire Island Pines. I did grow up going to Fire Island in terms of like, so because what people don't really know, or maybe they do, is that Fire Island is sort of known worldwide for being like an LGBTQ+ like vacation destination in the summer. That's been like a haven for decades, but that's probably about 5% of it, and the rest of it is extremely heterosexual, by which I mean like JWoww used to be a bartender there in Ocean Beach and Ocean Bay Park, and you know, it's an extremely heterosexual environment. In fact, I was just out on Fire Island last weekend, like I said, you know, promoting the movie and just being out there for the screening, and one of my friends had never been to the straight version of Fire Island. And mm-hmm. so they were like, what's it like? I'm like, if you can imagine all this debauchery that we see here in the Pines, but heterosexual, that's what it's like. And they're like, oh my God, I never want that. I was like, yeah, you're good. You're good never going. But it is fun. I'm dragging it, but it is fun. I love Ocean Beach.
You know, Tina Fey has a house in Fair Harbor. She's had a house there for like 20 years.
I did know that because, she's always had that Fair Harbor place. I think it's the same one, but, you know, not to say where she lives, but, and you know, it's like a lot of celebrities there pop in and out. It's like, it's quite coveted.
And I even remember like back in the day I was I still am a big SNL fan, but when I was, you know, coming up, you know, like in the year 2000, I was like my podcast would have been, instead of sort of like a Bravo Housewives adjacent pod, it would have been like an SNL like stalker podcast.
Totally. And I was the same way when I was younger. Yeah.
And I remember Tina Fey's first talk show appearance ever on Letterman in the year 2000 or 2001, when she first got Update, she tells a story about how she has this house on Fire Island and how they did a trip to the Pines and how it's like gay. She was talking about this on Letterman in the year 2000.
Yeah.
Look it up.
I think it is sort of like, it's interesting because it's both like a haven for queer people and also sort of like a little bit of like a sideshow for straight people that are on Fire Island that are like, we're going to pop by and see like, you know, the drag queens come in on the boat. And it's like, you know, they have fun doing it, but generally probably time is best enjoyed there when there are no straight people around. Yeah. And it's not to say, like, I don't want anyone listening to this podcast that might be straight to feel bad just because something's wrong with them. You know what I mean? Like, you just go be on your own beach.
What I also think is
not in front of my kids.
What I also think is so funny, like an observation, just like living on Long Island, growing up on Long Island. So I never grew up going to the Hamptons, about Fire Island. Like my parents, listen, I have two neurotic Jewish parents who like are afraid to leave the house. Like, trust me, we were never going anywhere. And it's funny to me that while people like you and I kind of have this whole, you know, we talk shit about Long Island as most Long Islanders do. If you keep going far enough, if you just stay on the Long Island Expressway, you will eventually hit Fire Island and the Hamptons. You just have to keep going. So that's sort of the irony.
At the end. You know, Fire Island's also a South Shore thing. It's really easy to get there on the South Shore. Like, you really have to travel out from the city. I mean, it's one of those, like, you take a train to a shuttle to a ferry moments, and you finally get out there, and then the party begins. Like, it's just absolutely exhausting in the best way. Like, I'm totally depleted right now from just spending a few days there. And I'm about to go back 4th of July. I'm going for the full week.
So. Oh, fun.
See you never.
Final thought about growing up on Long Island, and I know you love amusement parks. This is my number one question.
Okay.
Did you ever go to Action Park in New Jersey?
Not Action Park. So we never did Action Park. I did do Adventureland, or we called it Adventures Inn in
Huntington. Farmingdale. Farmingdale.
And I would go to Splish Splash sometimes, the water park. I honestly don't know why Action Park never came up in my childhood, but maybe it's because my parents had an idea at that point that it was like literally falling apart.
Did you see the documentary Class Action Park?
I did see it. And I was like, how did this get past me? I mean, it's definitely a place that, like, you know, middle-class Long Island, Jersey, upstate people would take their kids. But now I'm thankful I didn't, because I don't want to, like, you know, bust my leg open on like a water slide or whatever the hell happens there.
My best friend from growing up, he legit cracked a rib on a ride called the Human Slingshot.
I mean, if you're going to go on the Human Slingshot, at least have a story to tell afterwards. Like, if you know, that's the thing, is it's like, it would be boring to say you went to Class Action Park now, or Action Park. It's so funny. It would be boring to say that you went to Action Park now and didn't lose a limb. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to go,
what are you, a loser?
Exactly. Exactly. Don't tell me a boring story about the great time you had at Action Park. Like, why do you have both your eyes? You know,
I also grew up going to Adventureland. My dad would always take me to Adventureland, and I loved it. And did you ever do the thing where you could, like, kind of do a karaoke version of a music video? Like, you could. I vividly remember recreating the music video to Madonna, Open Your Heart.
Yeah.
And maybe that was the moment that I turned gay. But
maybe that was it. Honestly, I was not. I remember you could do that, but I was always very much like a little thrill seeker. Like, I was like a rough and tumble, like wanting to go on the rides. Like, I remember the roller coaster. That roller coaster that they used to have there, I don't know if they still have it, but it had one really steep drop in the middle of it. I was like, whoa. And then their haunted house was iconic. They had a cute little Ferris wheel that was right off the highway. I remember I would always pass it and be like salivating, wanting to go. And it's fine. You know what I mean? Like, it's a perfectly fine amusement park. And it's actually the basis for that movie Adventureland with Kristen Stewart and Ryan Reynolds. Yeah. Which, you know, they obviously didn't shoot it there, but it is the basis for it, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was, for a while, that was kind of like my claim to fame. Like, I was very proud that, like, this was the place that I grew up going. All right, Fire Island, I want to talk about your personal experiences. So do you remember the year that you first went? Like, what was your, like, when was the first time you went? And from what I remember, you didn't actually love it your first time. Like, it took time to kind of grow on you.
It's really like a huge mindfuck when you go there, because, you know, you have built it up in your head so much. Like, you've really, you know, you've come out of the closet years ago, you've become who you are, you think, you know, you think you're comfortable with yourself, and then all of a sudden you're given this opportunity to go to a place where, you know, it's notorious for, like, people having sex, people doing drugs, people going with their friends that they're really close with, having a great time, you know, fending for themselves for a week. And it's like, you know, in the same way that I used to get anxiety about going to summer camp or doing, you know, any type of sleepaway activity, I got that way about Fire Island because it just stirred up a lot of anxiety in me. And I think that that's actually a lot of what the movie is about too. You know, the pressure that gets put on this week being the best vacation week of your life. And so I think that I probably first really enjoyed it, let's call it like 2016, 2017, when I was like 26, 27 years old, had really figured out who I was, the people that I wanted to go with. And even then, like, you know, it was tough. Like it's touch and go. It's day to day. Some days you'll be like, oh my God, I had the best time of my life. Or some days you're like crying because no one will look at you in the club and you're too fucked up, or you are just feeling like it's going to take you forever to get home and you're exhausted and your serotonin is gone. I mean, it's a lot. So ultimately, last year, about a month before we had started shooting the movie, I had what I think was my first really good, altogether extremely positive experience there, because nowadays, like, I really do know who I am, especially now that I'm in my 30s. I've kind of like eschewed all those like 20 something things of like, you know, really caring super down to the detail of what I'm wearing, like what I look like, whether or not people are attracted to me. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you can't put out that energy. If you put out an energy of I'm having fun, I'm doing my thing, your experience is better there. And it's really all about who you surround yourself with. So I'm excited to go back next month, not for work, and be surrounded by, you know, my favorite people ever, because it really, when you let it, is the best place to let your brain break in half and just let yourself completely go, which I'm interested in.
Like, this movie is very much a story about the Pines.
Yes.
Now, obviously, there's Cherry Grove. But interestingly, even as a girl, I enjoy hanging out in the Pines because, like, I have a ton of gay guy friends and, like, I know where to stay. And, like, also, it's, like, a little bit nicer. However, yeah. I really have come to appreciate Cherry Grove because it does have this much more laid back feel. Plus, there's like ice cream there.
Yeah.
There's drag shows and like there's like older gay guys. And it's like, oh, like these are the people who I want to be around. So I'm curious.
It's just less high octane. You know what I mean? Like it's just, and Cherry Grove is in the movie a lot. I mean, because the Ice Palace like underwear party takes place in Cherry Grove. Like we see the Peppermint, the drag queen, is in the movie doing a drag show at Cherry Grove. At the Ice Palace as well during the day. And so a lot of Cherry Grove is depicted in the movie, but it is sort of where you go when you want to more see a show, chill, have dinner, you know, have more of that type of vibe, because the Pines is very, you know, geared toward partying. And not to say that Cherry Grove doesn't have parties, but it is. It's sort of like for families and lesbians. And then, you know, the Pines, for what it's worth, is overrun by like gay men. And
I would say Cherry Grove is for, yes, women and also gay guys who are over it. Gay guys who are over the Pines. Like I have a lot of guy friends that are like, it's too intense for me. I have a way better time chilling in Cherry Grove.
And the way that I feel about it is like the Pines is as intense as you let it be. You know, something I really want to stress, and something I think that is in the movie if people really watch it, is that this is a make your own experience type situation. It's make your own adventure, choose your own adventure, if you will. I mean, you can, you know, wake up early in the morning, get a coffee, take a beautiful walk. I mean, you know, one of the most beautiful things about the island, which I think is so lovingly depicted in the film, which was directed by Andrew Ahn and shot, our cinematographer was Felipe Vara del Rey, who's a genius, is that the beauty of the island really comes through. And, you know, I was just out there for 3 days and I said to my friend, like, I feel like I didn't get an opportunity to just take a walk with my AirPods in and just like connect with my own solitude and, you know, the nature around me. And it's also a wonderful place to just sit around and watch a movie. Last night, the last thing we did was we just watched the movie The Hours. I mean, it's just like truly like getting as gay and granular as possible with your group of friends. But, you know, and it's also a really great place to meet people in surprising ways. And, you know, the connections that you make and the little dalliances that happen and the friends that you end up bopping around with are very unexpected. And it is summer camp in that way. And it is feels like everything is very of the moment. moment. So don't look at it like this thing that's going to scare you away from it because you think that the pace of life is going to intimidate you or exhaust you.
You know, I recently interviewed Margaret Cho, and we were talking about Fire Island and her experiences on Provincetown, which I also love. This was obviously before I saw the movie, because this was like a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. And she sort of alluded to the story that she tells at the dinner party about, she wasn't as graphic with about right. the story with the flip phone. But from what I understand, that is her, that is a legit Margaret Cho story that actually happened to her.
Yeah, and that was actually one of my best memories on set, I think, because A, the whole cast was together, and Margaret sat at the head of the table, and it's this scene where all the boys are convening
The two houses are having a dinner
houses
party.
And some other special guests are convening, and they're having a dinner party, and Margaret is cooked, and she's sort of running stuff at the end of the table, and she's telling us a story. And I remember we got it a few different ways. We got it as scripted. We got it where she told a funny story, which is, you know, what ended up being in the movie about, you know, I won't spoil it, but like an encounter she had in the Meat Rock, which is like the woods of Fire Island.
It involves a flip phone for life.
It does. And you know, the possible discovery of a sexually transmitted infection on a sexual partner. But she also told very poignant personal real stories. And we got takes of her telling more serious stuff too about friends that she had known and lost. And so we got it many different ways. But what I was so struck by was that she was so filled to the brim with these types of stories. And I shouldn't have been struck by it because she is such an icon. And, you know, she's lived this queer experience for so long. And
I felt like she was crucial. I know that originally her part was written for like an older gay man.
It was actually cast with other people too. I mean, originally it was going to be, you know, I won't say who, but like a fancy gay actor, mm-hmm. Who is an older gentleman, and then he had to drop out, and the part was reconceived for Margaret when she was approached for it, and it came out that she wanted to do it, and now I actually think it's the only choice for that role.
It's pivotal because you need that lesbian experience.
Certainly you need a female energy.
You need the female energy, and Fire Island is not just made up of, even like, even the Pines, like I go there. So like, I like that representation even for myself. Legit, a friend texted me. He's like, by the way, I love the movie and I fully see you in 30 years as like Margaret Cho. With like, well, hopefully like I'll have people around.
That has its pros and cons. Yeah, right.
I was like, but, I love that you're saying that, but.
You know, this is someone who is a radical queer stand-up, and she's an Asian woman, and, you know, so obviously she had impacted Bowen and Joel as, you know, developing talents and as young children, really. I mean, because when we were teenagers, we were children. If the impact that she had on me is even 1/8 of the one that she had on Joel and Bowen, mm-hmm. then it's immeasurable, because you're talking about someone who's like truly a comedian's comedian, too. And so formative on all of our lives and our senses of humor.
Because I'm so familiar with both The Pines and Cherry Grove, because I know you only filmed on Fire Island for 2 weeks, but the total shoot was like 6 weeks. Which pieces were filmed on like a soundstage? Like, were the houses?
I will blow your mind. So this is some movie magic behind the scenes for everyone that's seen the movie. Everything exterior outside and the Fire Island Pines was shot in the Fire Island Pines, except the house where we stay was shot on Long Island. That was in Old Westbury. So we got
Margaret's house
that's our house in the movie. That was shot in Old Westbury. The rich people's house was shot in Sands Point. So that was all the way up on North Shore, Long Island, like, you know, where all those mansions are. And the pavilion and the ice palace are sets. So we did not actually shoot inside. And this to me is like one of the great testaments to how incredible our crew was. And I just want to say, like, really stress this, like, our crew was unbelievable. Those interior exterior transitions, like from the ice palace underwear party to the inside to outside inside, like, they're seamless.
But they really recreated the I was certain you filmed the pavilion at the pavilion.
We did not. So when we're doing the karaoke scene, singing the Sometimes by Britney Spears, and then we go outside, that is weeks apart, and we shot the pavilion on a set in Brooklyn, and then we walked outside and we were shooting actually on the pavilion dock. But yeah, that was just directed and edited and designed so seamlessly because all those interiors are sets.
Now, there's one thing you left out, which my friend, so I had watched it first like a few weeks ago, and then the other night I had friends over, actually friends that I share a share house with on the island. And so we had a viewing party here, and my one friend shouted out, "That is not the pantry."
It is not. It is not.
He's like, "Those shelves are too high." I was like, first of all, I don't think they have onions. Like, the produce didn't, he's like, "The shelving is too high." But on my first watch, yeah, it didn't cross my mind. I just like took it at face value.
Right, right. We could not shoot in the pantry because that would actually be sort of like, you know, occupying like the only grocery store on the island.
Yeah.
And also, I think there might have been a little bit of drama with the pantry because, you know, a lot of what we talk about in regards to the pantry is how expensive it is and them denting cans to try to get like, you know, discounts. But we made sure to throw in some really positive things about the pantry too, because it is iconic. And as long as we got to represent like a true pantry girl, we succeeded. And Marsha Belsky, a friend of ours, is a comedian who came in and she put that messy bun in. She put that sweatshirt on, that sleepy little sweatshirt, those little lacrosse shorts, the socks with slides. You know, like, she was giving Pantry Girl. And I actually was one of the Pantry Girls for Halloween last year.
I was just going to bring that up. I was literally waiting for you to finish so I could say, well, let's not forget your Halloween costume.
Yep, yeah, it was iconic. Honestly, I think it's that's my most proud Halloween costume ever. And way back in the day, even the great before, when you could dress up as a Harry Potter character without feeling weird, I was actually on a sexy Harry Potter's list. Okay. So this is huge for my Pines Pantry character that she was able to out legacy that.
Were there any alternate titles? Like, was it ever potentially going to be called The Pines, or what were some of the alternate titles?
One title that was thrown out there was Pines, like just, and then The Pines. I liked Pines because I thought it meant like pining, but also it was The Pines. Ooh. Like, ultimately, I do think Fire Island is the best title. But Joel really wanted it to be called Trip. It was actually originally called Trip at Quibi, and then it changed. But, you know, there was, of course, like, the first thought thing to call it like Pines and Prejudice, which I'm really happy we didn't. but you know, there were other titles thrown out there that I think before we landed on Fire Island, which feels so declarative and big. And there were definitely a lot of conversations about what to call it. But ultimately, I do think that Fire Island is the best title of it because, you know, an island on fire, like in terms of like emotionally and, yeah, you know, the you get the inflamed sense of, you know, the state of affairs, the emotional sort of mentality everyone's in. And it is the name of the place. And people do know it as the iconic destination that is for queers. So we nailed it on the name.
The iconic Marissa Tomei, the scene with you and Tomas, which like is clearly like the breakout scene. Was any of that improvised? Like, how much of your stuff was improvised?
I improvised a lot of jokes that ended up getting used, but I, of course, performed the script. So it is Joel Kim's script, and I also think that any improvisation that I do in a script that Joel Kim wrote, that's his stuff, because he's created the characters and the situations. And so, you know, I never take credit. I always just try to amplify and bring what I can bring, and I think that Joel knows me as a talent. He knows I'm an improviser, and I think he wrote that role for me so that I could inhabit it and do those things, and he certainly never seemed to have, like, a chapped ass about me adding a joke or punching something up in a way that I felt was natural to me. But in a scene like the Marissa Tomei heads up scene, Andrew Ahn, our director, said, "So we're not going to script this. You're going to just play heads up with Conrad with Marissa Tomei as the topic. And you and Tomas, I want you to do the scene." And I was like, got it. And Tomas, they're from Staten Island. So they had like a Marissa Tomei, My Cousin Vinny vocabulary. They knew the reference well, even though they're so young, you know, they're so culturally literate and so talented. But for me, it was just like a really good opportunity to employ my like tri-state area accent and say those iconic lines. And luckily for me, I get to work with someone like Tomas, who is such an energy match for me and such a great kitty to my Lydia. So it was very easy for us to sort of like get on board about the amount of energy we were going to bring and just how upset we were going to get. Because when you're working with someone like Tomas, who is like an endless fount of energy, you know, I'll go there too. Like, and that's just fun. And and they really let us just scream at Conrad Rickamora for a long time. I mean, we probably got like at least 30, 40 minutes of footage of that. Tomas was really hoarse afterwards. But yeah,
when you call him a flop at the end, like that's clearly you.
Yeah, that's me. I mean, you know, you have to, I always think like, you know, that's character creation anyway. You have what's on the page, and then luckily, or if you're lucky rather, you will find an actor that fills out the rest of it. And so I was happy to combine the elements of me that I thought were Luke-ish with the writing that Joel had provided. Yeah.
Now, I want to know, I know you're very close with your parents, good, still married, Long Island parents. How did you prepare them for your moment?
What happens to the character?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they are really supportive and respectful of what I do as an actor. And I told them about it. So I came back and I said that I had worked with an intimacy coordinator because there was a sex scene in the movie. And I explained to them that the issue of consent is in question. And I basically kind of told them, you know, about the challenge that it was like as an actor before I told them like about like the nudity. And to be honest with you, it is pretty blink and you miss it. But for me, what's impactful about all that is the actual content of what is happening. And, you know, the idea that consent is in question and that there's been a drug use involved in potentially blurring someone's reality when they engage in a sexual act. So I really just told them about that and that it served the plot and, you know, that it would be happening. I didn't like, you know, Titanic, Kate Winslet, them, where I like put my hands over their eyes. I mean, I didn't sit next to them at the premiere. Let's just say that. I had one of my friends sit in between us and my friend Sudi, who sat next to me, was like, do you want to sit next to your mom? And I was like, no, it's okay. And, you know, it happened and they saw it and I'm sure they're going to watch it again on Hulu. I hope they do. I hope to have much more sex on camera as characters other than myself, because it means I'll be playing characters with full experiences.
Yeah. Like how did, yeah. So like that's your parents, but like when you read the script and saw that you were going to have to like be the full Lydia moment and the way in which it was going to be interpreted for the movie, how did you feel? Just even like the day that you were shooting that, like, did you have nerves? Because clearly you've never done something like this before.
Right. No, I had never worked with an intimacy coordinator before. I had never really done anything like this before in terms of a sex scene, or I'd never been this nude on camera before. You know, I'm just not used to any aspect of it. And honestly, I had never really played a character with an arc before. And I haven't even really done that much dramatic acting, to be honest with you. But I think that when I first audition for it, you know, that scene of the aftermath of that video, you know, being posted when there's the issue of consent being raised, I read it as comedy at first because I was like, oh, I'll try to make this funny. And then when I tried to play the truth of it, I could really only authentically play it as someone having a panic attack because they feel their sexual autonomy is being taken away from them when a video of them fucked up and having sex is posted to the internet without their explicit consent. And I even judged myself for thinking it would be played for comedic effect at first. I was like, you know, it's so interesting that I was willing to make myself a joke or part of the joke instead of taking this seriously. But I think that honestly, in the gay community, we so don't talk about the ways in which we're made uncomfortable by sex because we all want to seem super down and super progressive and super, you know, sexual and sexually confident. You know, it is a currency. And I think that if there's one emotional thread that's hanging at the end of the movie, it is for the character of Luke, who will probably be dealing with that and unpacking it for a while because he's had a traumatic experience.
Shifting gears a little bit, was it not Joel Kim Booster who told you and Bowen to tamper down the housewives talk on Las Culch, and why?
Yeah, he actually said that one time because there was like a sea change in Las Culturistas content when Bowen and I decided to go full tilt housewives fan. And that's not to say that the podcast is a full tilt housewives podcast, but I do think they get mentioned on almost every episode. I would never call us a housewives podcast, no shade. I would just say it It has.
This is not a Housewives podcast.
And I'm not saying it's you. I'm saying it to anyone out there who has a Housewives podcast who is like, oh, that's shady. I love Housewives podcasts. They're actually the only ones I listen to. And that's because they talk about the shit that I want to hear. And also shout out to this podcast, obviously, which I love. But I really think that Joel was just sensitive to the fact that he had friends that listen to the podcast that aren't Housewives people. And he was like, you guys realize you talk about this so much and you have so many fans that don't watch them. Mm-hmm. And I will say, like, sometimes I'm self-conscious about it because I know that some people just genuinely look down upon that interest that is Housewives, but I really don't care. And at this point, I'm like, gonna talk about what I want to talk about. Yeah. And if it happens to be Meredith Marks, who I met, by the way, at the Fire Island premiere, then so be it.
With Brooks Marks and Seth.
Okay, so I met Meredith. And so picture this. I am rolling up to the Fire Island premiere. I'm wearing Versace. I'm like getting ready to hit the carpet. This is the big moment. I get out. The publicist Shelby from Searchlight looks at me and goes, Meredith Marks is here. I beeline away from the carpet, walk over to her, and I'm like, oh my God. I didn't even introduce myself. I was like, I'm in the movie and I'm a huge fan. And I just want to say, like, it's so cool that you're here. And she was like, oh my God, that's so exciting. Thank you so much. And she introduced me to Seth. I gave them both a hug, took a picture with Meredith. And I was like, I've talked to Brooks a little bit online. And she was like, oh, he's going to be here shortly. I didn't get to meet him, but she did DM me later because she didn't realize who I was, I guess. And she had followed me a while back because I was one of the first to buy the full Brooks Marks tracksuit. Yeah. And I modeled it and everything and like really like posted about it because I love it. It's really comfy. And I just like, I'm a Housewives consumer. Like I will support the girls and the boys. And she was very, very, very sweet about that and really appreciated that. And they're a sweet family. I didn't get to meet Brooks, but there is an iconic, there's footage of an interview I'm doing on the carpet and the whole Marks family is like on the line behind me, like taking photos and like being together. And it's just me like, you know, spouting off about like Chosen family and the themes of the film. And then the Marks are in the back just like being iconic.
Now, you gave what I think is the greatest performance on Watch What Happens Live history.
Wow, that is amazing of you to say. I felt truly good about it, but that is high praise.
It was the best performance.
I'm so thrilled that you say that. And Bowen and I are going back on June 14th to promote Fire Island, Bowen Yang and I together.
However,
here we go.
You said in front of God and everyone that people who say they want Bethany back are lazy. I want you to expand on
that.
Okay, I want you to expand on this thought.
Because I do not believe she's net positive for the show because I think that she now thinks who she is. And I think that she is too producerial and her ego is too out of control. And so I think that she cannot actually return to the show and play ball on a level playing field with everyone else. I also think that she seems online like she doesn't seem very happy to me. Like, and the energy doesn't seem good. Bethany lost me forever with the way that she treated Carol that last season. That was just, it was beyond the pale for me when she said she had no career, which was something that she said to explicitly hurt her because she knows how much Carol cares about that and how much it means to her. I see Bethany for what she is, which is like a wannabe Housewives producer. Mm-hmm. And just superiority is not an attractive quality for me. And, you know, I do think she's hilarious when she's on. I do think that she is compelling in terms of drama when she's surrounded by equals. But she seems to think she's a lot better than this now. And I don't like it. So I don't necessarily need her back. I just don't think it's required the way that some New York fans seem to think it is. I do think it's lazy.
Here is why New York fans like myself think that she is the missing piece in order to bring it back to greatness. And it will probably never reach those heights again. Here is why. There was an interview with Carlos King, who was the main producer on Atlanta in the early years of Jersey. And he was interviewing. He did this fucking wild interview with Ebony K. Williams that is batshit. However, Ebony did make one very good point. She said that Bethany is what is called in the sports world as a force multiplier.
Yeah, like essentially increases the gifts and talents of others just by being there. Yeah.
Yes. Right. She raises everyone up to another level. And I don't
because
think...
she gets under Ramona Singer's skin, and what we want to see is Ramona Singer stressed out. We want to see Luann called out for being hoity-toity and out of touch. We want to see, you know, yeah, we want Sonia to spin out because she's not really thought things through. I mean, Bethany knows what buttons to press for sure.
Yeah, like, I feel like she elevates everybody else. And I don't think she's ever going to come back, but I do think this is kind of where the road ends. And also, I do want to say, as far as like the Roni split, I don't get why they didn't just Roni, like they should just do Real Housewives Brooklyn, like call it
That's
like Roni Brooklyn. Like, why can't
Joel
they
and
just
I are
that?
On the same page about this. We wanted there to be continue New York for what it is and stop trying to make it into what you're trying to make it into, because unless they're all authentically friends, it's just not going to work. And I would have loved to see Real Housewives of Brooklyn, which is, you know, a very different vibe and could have been a lot younger and cooler and more diverse. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they're too similar. And also, you have to imagine that most people who are like living in Brooklyn probably work in Manhattan. It is interchangeable, but I think it would have been interesting. I certainly think it would have been more interesting than Legacy versus actual Roni. I think it's fuzzy and not altogether very clear. I just think the split right now and the way they've talked about it, it feels very vague to me.
Yeah. Did you ever hear, there was an episode of some other show, this was like a year and a half or 2 years ago, Andy Cohen was on and he was actually talking about you and Joel Kim Booster. Like, do you know what I'm talking about? And
he was on Homophilia and he said he had a crush on me.
So I want to go deeper on this.
Okay.
Are you ready to be a father of two?
I think no, because, well, first of all, no. And second of all, I don't think he's actually interested in me. I think, because, you know, when we met at Watch What Happens Live, I'll just say he was surprised by how tall I was. I think he thought I was small. And I don't know if he likes small guys, because it wasn't like he hit on me a bunch. You know what I mean? It was like we had a really great time, and I think I was good on the show, and he liked that. He immediately asked me when I could come back, mm-hmm. which I was excited about. But it wasn't like a horny, flirty energy. I didn't think. Did you think it was? Did you think he was like hitting on me?
No, I thought he was incredibly impressed with you.
Well, that's nice, and you know, maybe that's why he didn't treat me like, you know, whatever, which is nice, because honestly, ultimately, like, I would like to keep going back and doing his show for the rest of my career. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need it to be weird with me and Andy Cohen, but I was extremely flattered that he said that. I mean, it's who doesn't want to hear that from Andy Cohen?
And going back to when I said that you did give the greatest performance, like, period, they designed that entire episode around you.
Well,
every game. Every game, it was brilliant. I'm very excited for this episode with you and Bowen. Didn't Bowen think he was banned for calling Ramona
racist? There's a little
bit
of drama. So basically, and I think I can say this because, you know, Bowen had some choice words for Ramona Singer. The words were white supremacist. And they didn't end up using that on the show. And Bowen, I think, felt that maybe they were angry at him for going as hard at Ramona as he did. And he thought maybe he was, quote unquote, banned, which he is not. And I verified that with Andy, and I am going back with Bowen. But there definitely is, like, you know, they want you to pop off on Watch What Happens Live. Like, they get you drunk, let's be clear. But, you know, there is a line. And I think, you know, Bowen and I are sort of line bridgers in many ways, and I think that it's interesting to know where that line is, where that line lies. Like, you know, I did my I Don't Think So Honey about people saying Mauricio is the hottest house husband, but really it's Evan. But I had another one in mind, which, you know, I didn't do because I think that it was sort of hinted to me that maybe it would be too far.
What was it?
I was gonna do I Don't Think So Honey Gia. But I was advised that maybe Teresa's fans wouldn't love that. And, you know, it wouldn't be net positive for all involved. But, you know, who knows? Who knows? I do not think so, honey, Gia. Let's just be clear.
You know, yes. I Don't Think So, Honey is the centerpiece of Las Culch. And I would like to deliver one right now.
Oh, my gosh.
If I may.
You may. Would you like me to put you on the clock?
Yeah, put me on the clock.
So here we go. I'm bringing it up. This is Jess's I Don't Think So, Honey. Your time starts now.
I don't think so, honey. Podcasters with bad audio. This is the one job you have. Make your show sound good. I don't think so, honey. I don't think so, podcasters who go on other podcasts and don't plug in a USB mic. Matt Rogers is right here. He came prepared. He has headphones and he has a proper mic. I don't think so, honey. I don't think so, honey. Podcasters who do not edit their shows. Editing is next to godliness. If you don't edit, you're a fucking flop.
30 seconds.
I don't think so, honey. Podcasters who don't give a shit about the audience, who let their guests run on and on and on with no direction, not telling a story. It's storytelling. This is the medium.
15 seconds.
I don't think so, honey. Period. Save the 15 seconds.
Wow. Okay. Huge. So I have to say, and I want to just, you know, peek behind the curtain for the audience. She did tell me to get more up on this mic. And the only reason I wasn't, okay, because I am a mic eater. You know my show, like I'm up on the mic. The only reason I wasn't is because I'm in this damn hotel and I'm sitting on like the literal edge of my bed and I have my little rinky dink like travel mic with me. But just so you know, I take that just as seriously as you do, honey. Whenever I hear a podcast and week in and week out, they have shit audio, I'm like, where are the producers? How is the talent okay with this? The listeners I know are pissed off because the second audio quality dips, like they'll go somewhere else. They'll listen to something more crisp that's literally about the same thing because there is a podcast for every subject, not just one. There's three podcasts for every subject, even niche shit. Okay, so up your game.
And a little even addendum to this, I don't think so, honey, is I don't think so, honey, Bethany Frankel's podcast. Half the time that fucking mic isn't even plugged in. She has Just Be behind her. It's not plugged in. It's like not even lit up. You can see wires dangling in the background. Aren't you like a multimillionaire? Plug the wires in. You can get somebody to hide the wires behind the couch. Her audio is shit. It sounds different when she's just doing a rant and it sounds different in an interview. Don't you have a producer?
I know.
I don't think so, honey.
There you go. There was your other 15 seconds. What I'm so annoyed about Bethany is like whenever anyone drags her or like comes for her, her response is the same, which is always, well, I don't even know who that is. And you know, they're probably like, she just acts like, well, what do I care? It's like, no girl, you're getting a legit note, which is we want to hear your podcast and the audio was bad and you are a rich woman. So get your mic together and plug in the damn sign. Like, it's really not that
hard. She has iHeartRadio behind her. They clearly have editors and producers. How does this producer still have a job?
Honestly, you have to ask questions about
what?
About like how she's treating people. You know what I mean? Because someone probably has said, hey, do you want like a nice mic? No. Because she thinks she knows everything. Whatever.
And by the way, I agree with everything you're saying regarding Bethany. Like, I just find her endlessly fascinating and love to talk about her. But I agree, she's a total pain in the ass. This episode is brought to you by the podcast Pop Pantheon. Every Thursday, DJ Louie XIV is joined by pop critics and super fans to overanalyze all your favorite pop stars, from the icons like Beyonce all the way down to the lesser icons like Nicole Scherzinger, and then rank them in the official Pop Pantheon. Now, I highly recommend the Madonna episode with Rich Jesuiak. I absolutely love that episode. What I love is that DJ Louie invites music critics to get in on the conversation, music critics from The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, Pitchfork, and The New York Times, as well as Ira Madison III, Evan Ross Katz, like I said, Rich Jesuiak, talking about Madonna. He's the most incredible mind dissecting and analyzing the pop stars that we all love. So if you love hot takes and deep dives, I certainly know you're going to love Pop Pantheon. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts every single Thursday. Can't wait to see you there. It can be super hard to connect with somebody on a dating app when it's just predicated on their profile, a couple of pictures, and then some vague texting back and forth. Then you get to that date and you can tell within a few minutes that there's no chemistry whatsoever. That's when I heard about this new dating app called Filter Off. With Filter Off, it sets you up on a really quick 3-minute video date before you waste time getting ready or hopping in the car or the train to meet somebody for an expensive date. So yeah, just imagine the ability to go on a date that is not predicated on someone's ability to send a text message. I love the concept of Filter Off as a video dating app. So go to getfilteroff.com, use promo code DIVES5 to receive 5 extra daily picks. getfilteroff.com. That's getfilteroff.com and use the promo code DIVES5. DIVES5. Filter Off. Date the person, not the profile. I want to get into the origin story of Las Culturistas and how you and Bowen became really close. You met at NYU, right?
So we met there like our freshman year, and then didn't become close until like later on in college.
And is it true that you guys weren't friendly from, were you like floor mates?
We had a lot of mutual friends when we were freshmen, and he was on the improv group at NYU and I was on the sketch group, and we both slowly came out, and I think we were both fully gay and out like our sophomore years of college, and our respective comedy groups were like, okay, now the gays will play together, like we have a gay and you have a gay and they'll be friends, like do it. And we were like resentful of that, like, no, we're not going to be friends just because we're gay, like stop, that's reductive, etc. And then I remember we were at the same like college party and Nicki Minaj came on, I think Super Bass came on, and we were like, we both knew, and it was a deluxe track at the time, like it was not regularly on her album. Yeah. But we both knew every word and it had just come out. And so we found each other on the dance floor and like did this whole performance. And I was like, oh, so maybe we will be friends just because of our gay interests.
It sounds like you had a dance off with Bowen Yang.
We essentially like lip synced the song together and it was truly a moment. And I was like, never mind, you are my sister. And then we, to varying degrees of closeness over the next couple of years, like always worked together. And then we really became very, very close, like after college, because we started working together on projects more. And then the podcast started in 2016. And it was just really for us to set aside 90 minutes a week to like just have playtime together, never thinking anyone would listen to it.
So you guys, initially you guys were self-produced independently?
It wasn't self-produced. We actually had, so Forever Dog was the name of the production company that we were with, and they were friends of ours from college, and they were like, we would like you guys to do a podcast, whatever you guys want to do. We were like, yeah, sure. Maybe 60 people a week will listen to this. Mm-hmm. We called it Las Culturistas because it was the dumbest thing we could think of. We were like, okay, I guess we need a segment. So we created this I Don't Think So Honey segment, which is like a 1-minute rant on something in culture we don't like, which is truly the most first thought thing ever. But we did put our own spin on it and started to do our own little segments and bits in the show. And I think the reason people liked it is because, for that very reason, we really didn't think anyone would listen to it. So we were very ourselves. Yeah, it just started to do well.
What's been so interesting, I went back and listened to an episode you did where basically throughout like months of you guys doing the podcast, what was going on in the background where you were auditioning for SNL.
Totally. I mean, it was one of the weirdest things because one of the things about the podcast that I like the most is that we are so honest and we're so upfront about what's going on in our lives. And, you know, by that same token, you're still really the whole time doing the podcast and being myself or whatever on the podcast, like behind the scenes, I am trying to make like a career in comedy happen. And I do see myself first and foremost as an actor and a performer before I am this like podcast personality. And so here I am in the situation where both of those things are reaching real potential. I'm in my, you know, very late 20s and finally get the opportunity after being at UCB for years and years and doing sketch comedy for years. I finally get the opportunity to audition for Saturday Night Live. Weirdly simultaneously and totally irrespective of me, so does Bowen. Mm-hmm. And so it's this very weird position that we found ourselves in because when you're in New York and you're doing comedy, it's like, and SNL is such a thing. You know, it's like mm-hmm. this like end of the road sort of fairy tale place that we all are trying to get. And then very few of us get the opportunity, and very, very few of us get the opportunity where you do well with the opportunity. And then almost none of us, literally almost none of us, get the actual chance to be on the show. So it was interesting because we were best friends dealing with not only doing this together, the whole thing of going through the process, every step of the process together, but also running this business together, which is our comedy career, and having the podcast, and so many ups and downs in both of those things, and then ultimately it going one way for him and another way for me.
Were you auditioning to be writers or performers?
So when you audition to to be on the show, you're essentially, you showcase and you tape and test to be on the cast. But what they can do is they can decide that if they like you but don't want to put you on the cast, or feel you're not ready, or feel you need time, or like your talent and want to utilize it in other ways, what they can do is they can offer you to be on the writer's room instead of just putting you on the cast.
Right. Okay.
So when we ultimately auditioned, he had tested like 4 times. It was like his 4th time testing, and he had had near misses almost every time, and it was just this crazy up and down. And it was my 2nd time testing. Mm-hmm. So they had both put us on a hold. Like, it was this crazy long, long, long process.
What does it mean if they put you on hold?
So basically, being on hold means that you sign a contract. So before you even test, you have to sign a contract that's like literally the SNL contract, and it details how much money you're going to make and how long it is. And it's a 7-year contract.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically says that you work only at Broadway Video's like discretion, essentially. Like, I don't even know if I'm saying too much, but I don't think so. It's pretty well known that it's a tough contract.
Mm-hmm.
And so I signed it, because you're not allowed to test without signing it. And essentially that locks you in for 7 years if they want. And we both signed that contract. And in that contract, it also says we have the right to, now that you've signed it, put you, quote unquote, on hold if we want to, which means you're not on the cast, but you can't work elsewhere. So essentially, we screen tested in March, just because they felt like screen testing in March that year. They probably weren't going to put anyone on. Mm-hmm. And both did well enough that they put us on hold. So what that meant was we had to pretty much agree to not work in film and television for that whole 6-month period until August, September, when we auditioned again.
What did you guys do for income?
Luckily, we had the podcast, and we had we were starting to do well with touring. Okay. So like, we did I Don't Think So Honey Live. And so basically it was okay, because we both were writing freelance for Vulture, doing like RuPaul's Drag Race recaps. And so we were getting by, but it certainly was a tough contract. And then at the end of it, Bowen got a job there and I didn't. And so
How did you react to that? Like, when he calls you and basically says, I got our dream job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was every emotion. That's really, because it was really the 2nd time I had gone through that, because my other best friend's name is Sudie Green, and she was put as a writer on that show when we were 24.
Wow.
And so she's still there now, and she even was on the like panel and like watched our tape at 30 Rock. I mean, it was
crazy.
Like,
wow.
The specific situation that I found myself in, where it was both my best friends and me in that situation, and then ultimately them getting to work there and me not, was very character building. Because it was like intense pride in both of them. But also, you know, I'm not going to lie and say that there wasn't a lot of envy. Because then it was also the situation of, you know, you blow off steam and want to talk about things that you're going through, and they're telling me, you know, how the job is hard, or how the job is unfair sometimes, or how the job is great and how the job is fun and things like that. And it's just, you know, once you've gotten really close to that and you're hearing about it, it does filter in a different way. And also there's the lost potential of working there all together. But ultimately, I just don't think that's the right job for me, which is so weird to say, because I really thought I was positioned for it. And like, I worked to make my skill set exactly for that show. But ultimately, I will say, as hard as it was, and I did have like probably a 6-week to 2-month period of just true depression, like waking up every morning, opening my eyes and being like, why am I even doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Finally, you get to the other side and you do see that everything happens for a reason, and you do understand that there is so much more in the entertainment industry and so many more opportunities that you're going to have. But it's hard for someone who grew up on Long Island and studied at UCB.
Yeah.
And every time you go home for the holidays, everyone's like, when are you going to be on SNL? When are you going to be on SNL? To actually get that chance and to actually get that close. I remember after my first audition, after my first test, when it went so well, I remember I got home and looked at myself in the mirror and I said to myself, like, you might actually really do this. Like, you might actually really pull this off.
Mm-hmm.
And to not get it was tough. It was one of the toughest things I've been through.
Yeah.
But I'm ultimately only grateful that I got to experience that, because who gets to experience that? And then now I get to be so proud that, you know, not only are my two best friends working there, but they both bring such unique, important perspectives to the show. You know, they're both people of color. Sudi is a writing supervisor there. She's a woman. It's not super easy, but it's important, and she does amazing work there. Bowen, as we all know, or if we don't know, then we should know, is the first Chinese-American person to ever be on the cast. Like, they really don't put a lot of Asian people on that cast at all. Yeah. I mean, and also, not for nothing, but he's a gay man who's unapologetically gay on that show and does gay content. And, you know, there have been a lot of years where they have rooms full of gay writers, but it's just not on screen. And so it's huge for him to be there. It's huge for Kate to be there. It has been for years. And I'm ultimately so proud of them. Sometimes little darkness eeks in and it can be a little hard sometimes, but it's not a job for me.
You and Bowen have this bit about Sutton hosting SNL.
I know. Sutton Strack with musical guest Candace.
And
when I have a dream of it.
And also, like, Crystal, you're like, oh, I know Rob. I know Rob.
Well, we said Bowen was threatening to whip out his Crystal Kung Minkoff impression and it would change everything for him on SNL. He'd finally break out. No, but we just always have jokes about, like, you know, a housewife eventually, like, hosting the show, because it would never happen, but it is fun to think about. Because, you know, what's so funny is, like, all those SNL cast members, like, and a lot of people from I Love That For You, my other show, like, are die hard Housewives people. Like Vanessa Bayer, you know, you see her on Watch What Happens Live. She's die hard.
Molly Shannon
will jam about the Housewives. You know, me and Molly Shannon actually met for the first time at Countess Lou and Friends concert. So I was writing for the other two, the second season of the other two.
For the second season?
Yeah.
Love.
Yeah, it's a great show. And I went with the creators, Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider, to a Countess Lou and Friends show, and Molly Shannon joined us. So we got absolutely wasted together. And there was a moment in the show where you get to go up and ask a question. And so I sort of knew Ben Rimmelauer and I are like acquaintances. We're like, you know, we're very friendly. And he was directing the show. And I amble over to the mic. I'm wasted. I really don't have a question, but I was just like feeling my oats and like sort of three sheets to the wind. And Ben Rimmelauer says to Lou, he goes, "Oh, Lou, look, it's Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas." And everyone's drunk in the audience, barely listening. And Lou just goes, "Oh, yeah, of course, darling. Oh, you look absolutely stunning, darling. Thank you for coming to the show. Of course it's you." And I was like, "Hey, Lou, it's so great to see you. I just want to know," I have no question, I'm like shooting from the hip, "what's the deal with Carol?" And the whole audience like goes, "Ooh." And she just like, it was like bump, set, spike. She just goes, "Who?" And the whole audience, of course, erupts in applause. And she goes, "I haven't spoken to that woman since we wrapped the show." And everyone's like gagging, gagging, gagging. I, you know, stumble my way back over to our seats. And Molly Shannon looks at me and she goes, "That was a really good question." And then years later, like in the makeup chair during the pilot, I went over to her and I was like, "Molly, it's so nice to meet you. I'm so excited to work with you. You'll never remember this, but we actually met at a Countess Luann and Friends concert." And she looks at me and she recognizes me and she goes, "Oh my God, yes, you asked that really good question," which was literally just, "What's the deal with Carol?" I love it.
Oh my God. What would be like your dream project? Like at this point, like you're on like a Showtime series and like you have a feature film. Like if you could design it yourself, like what would you want to do?
I would love to do a rom-com where I was the lead. You know what I mean? Like I would love to do that. There's so many great actors out there that I would love to do something like that with, like, you know, like Joel Kim or even Bowen or like, you know, like Johnny Sibili or like, you know, like someone fun like that. And like, that's, you know, hot and upcoming and doing some fun stuff. And, you know, anyone from this movie, I mean, how incredible is Conrad Riccamora as a leading man? Like he's the incredible, the Darcy of our time. But I would love to do that. I would love to have like a vehicle for myself. And I would love to do a big comedy movie with Bowen, like in the style of Barb and Star. We're working on some stuff and, you know, just really continue to work on I Love That For You, because I really do love the character, and I'm so happy that people seem to be finding the show, because, you know, we need people to stream to get that second season. But, you know, I'm so lucky. I live under such a lucky star. I get to, like, essentially have fun on projects that I think are cool and people like, and then actually stand by, and I can come here and talk to people like you about the stuff that I'm doing, and, you know, I get to enjoy every minute of it because I actually think it's good, you know? When I come back and my energy is different, you'll know I hate the project. I've been spoiled. I've been really spoiled.
I love it. Matt Rogers, I love you. Yes. Like, I, like, truly, you're, like, my favorite. You really are.
I love you back. And when I heard that you wanted to talk to me again, I was really excited. And I was like, absolutely, because you're such good vibes and great energy. You're GVO, as Dr. Wendy once said. Actually, she said it many times.
Oh, my God. I love it. Who would be your dream housewife to have on the pod?
We've had Dr. Wendy and we've had Garcelle, mm-hmm. and they've been incredible. And I think if I could have a third, I mean, Karen Huger wants to come on. Like, I think for the season two premiere of Potomac, we'll have to have her. And I've also had some loose conversations with Whitney Rose and Meredith Marks. So for Salt Lake City, I think them. And, you know, outside of that, I mean, in terms of housewives coming on the pod, I always want to make sure that it feels like we can have a full conversation with them about everything. Mm-hmm. So Kyle Richards, Lisa Rinna, I certainly wouldn't scoff at, like, say,
okay, here,
I guess, like, a Kenya Moore, you know what I mean?
Here's the,
like,
question. You get an email. Knock, knock.
Yes.
You got Bethany and Erica Jane. They both want to come on Las Culch. Which one are you going to take?
I pick Erica.
Wow. I hate Bethany.
It's not that I hate Bethany. I don't hate Bethany. I just don't want to talk to her. You know what I mean? Like, Erica, I think, says interesting things because she's less rehearsed and thought out. Like, I think that her I don't give a fuckness is, like, interesting to me. Whereas, like, Bethany's I don't give a fuckness is, like offensive to me. Like, it's just like, okay, I understand. Like, I get it. Like, you think you're better than everything about this. I also know people that have had her on their podcast and it wasn't a good experience.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Same.
That's something that I've heard.
Listen.
More than once.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as Erica Jane once said to Dorit, I say important shit. You say too much boring shit.
You know, and you say Dorit, and honestly, it wouldn't kick her off the podcast these days either, to be honest with you.
Tell everybody, Fire Island is streaming on Hulu. Matt Rogers, though. Where did tell me why it's Matt Rogers, though.
I don't know.
This is a burning question I have.
Matt Rogers, though. Like, oh, Matt Rogers, though. Like, can you believe? Like, I don't know. I honestly don't know why I did that, but it is what it is now. I can't change it. I have, I think, the most popular name in America. Everyone, actually, I'm checking my notes here. Yes, everyone is named Matt Rogers. And so I needed to sort of have something else. But, you know, it is what it is. Like, and Andy Cohen would not stop calling me Matt Rogers, though, on Watch What Happens Live. And I was like, is this flirting? Or is this just, I asked him, I was like, you love that. You love my handle. And he was like, I think it's so cute. And I was like, okay.
You're going to be a daddy.
I'm not. I'm going to be a good friend.
A good friend. A good friend. Thank you so much. I love you.
Thank you. I love you back.
Everyone, please follow me at JessXNYC on Instagram. You can watch a video of this interview with Matt over on my Instagram or on YouTube. And we'll see you next week.
Grand Canyon University, an affordable private Christian university, is one of the largest and fastest growing universities in the country, offering more than 270 programs online. In addition to federal grants and aid, GCU's online students received nearly $130 million in institutional scholarships in 2022. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu/myoffer to see the scholarships you may qualify for.